Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. If you've seen the ESPN documentary O.J. Made in America, you know it's about a lot more than O.J. Simpson or the Brown-Simpson-Goldman murders or even the trial that once captivated the nation. It's a story about race, about identity, and about self-perception, and most of all, about the relationship between police and their community. It's a little bit frightening that this story from 22 years ago is still playing out with police and communities in every corner of America. The story took place in 1994 and 1995, but the issues raised in Ezra Edelman's stunning documentary are just as relevant today. Joining me here on Radio Who, What, Why to talk about it is one of the attorneys that was part of Simpson's so-called Dream Team. Carl Douglas was the managing attorney in the law office of Johnny Cochran, and he had a seat at the table for every aspect of this American tragedy. It is my pleasure to welcome Carl Douglas to Radio Who, What, Why.
Jeff, my pleasure having me, my friend.
It's great to have you here. One of the things that the documentary brings out, it reminds me, it's not possible to really understand almost any aspect of this story without really understanding the issue of race in Los Angeles and the LAPD in the 80s and 90s.
And you know, Jeff, I thought that was a fabulous focus of the documentary, beginning as it does, telling the story of Los Angeles. I'm a resident here since I was 2 years old. This is the city that I love. But it is virtually impossible for anyone to even begin to understand how some crazy jury could find Mr. Simpson not guilty without appreciating the context of my city at that time.
And not only the city at that time, but really the 20-year history that had come before, even, you know, arguably longer than 20 years, and what had gone on between the LAPD and the black community, things that were in many ways a precursor to what we've been seeing playing out as recently as last week in Dallas and Ferguson in Baton Rouge.
Indeed. And, you know, those stories that were told are stories that I am well familiar with, beginning with the story of the death of Leonard Detweiler in the early 60s and going through all of the things there. But that really was the first time I had ever seen those stories juxtaposed as they were on film. And so it really was for me the greatest description and depiction of my great city and the troubling history that I've ever seen on film.
The other thing that it's a reminder of is that the people that live in the better neighborhoods in these cities have no idea what's going on in these rough urban neighborhoods. And we see it in this story with respect to Los Angeles, but it's certainly something playing out in other cities as well.
Indeed, that is so, and regrettably, that is so even today. I continue to try civil rights cases in and around Los Angeles, and I am continually confronted with trying to explain to my Anglo brethren the fact that there are indeed two Americas, where police really do treat their residents with respect and there is a sense of trust.
And with this as the backdrop, it is even more fascinating to look in this documentary at the fact that O.J. Simpson strode the center of this divide and was even confused about his own identity.
I'm not sure, Jeff, if I would say that he was confused. He knew always that he was a black man, but he strived to attain beyond race. He wanted to really live the ideals of Martin Luther King and being judged by the content of his character and not by the color of his skin. He was well aware of his own blackness, but he was seeking to attain a different level of accomplishment, if you will, where and in fact for many years he did sort of quasi attain that level where he was looked at beyond the color of his skin. And I know as an African American kid growing up in Los Angeles, it was always great inspiration to me to see someone who looked like me running through the airports for Hertz or selling Chevrolet automobiles or even drinking RC Cola, which he used to sell in the early 60s.
But there was never any participation on his part in any of the causes of the day. That's one of the points that Edelman makes in the documentary, that he lived in a very different world. There's a scene in the documentary, and you probably remember better than I exactly where it takes place, a bar or someplace where O.J. is surrounded by other African-Americans. And somebody makes the comment, you know, what's O.J. doing hanging out with all those black people?
Yeah. And you know, it was a reflection of the different nature of his outlook on race, because he was proud that white person commenting did not see O.J. as black, which is disturbing to me. But that's just, you know, the nature of how he looked at himself. And it's interesting because one of the most troubling or counterintuitive things that my white friends are always difficult to understand, and in fact, the inconsistency is discussed repeatedly in the documentary, and that is the notion of O.J. Simpson being used as a civil rights symbol because of this disconnect that he always had with the African-American community. And I have always tried to explain the celebration of African-Americans across this globe to the verdicts as not being, Jeff, a referendum on O.J. Simpson, the person, but rather a celebration of the accomplishments of black professionals and the notion that competence comes in all colors. And people often have a difficulty understanding how O.J. Simpson could ever be used as a symbol for racial injustice given his background.
And that's the underlying irony of it. But I guess the broader question is, as you watch O.J. decline in the course of this story, is did he pay a price for that? Was there a psychological price that he paid for that confusion, for that straddling two worlds?
You know, when he stands before his maker, I'm sure that'll be the final judge of that, Jeff. I know, and the film reflects it, O.J. was seduced by the lure of white celebrity. And the depth with which he fell, as reflected in the final episode of this great documentary, is indeed a testament to how he was never ever able to recapture the attraction and the positivity of the majority community, and how that lack of appreciation drove him to the morass with which he found himself.
I have to ask you this, because it's somebody else that you know and have worked with. Did Michael Jackson suffer from the same thing, that lure of the white community? I mean, somebody else that did everything, including surgery, to be part of the white community.
You know, and that is a fascinating question, and both individuals are really complex in similar ways and in different ways. Certainly, Michael Jackson did not seem to use his celebrity to embrace some of the issues that were particularly endemic to the African-American community. Some might say he was a little younger, perhaps, and not as sophisticated, but I can appreciate the parallels that one would seek to draw and how celebrity can change you significantly, not always for the better.
Back to the O.J. story, were you surprised, you or Johnny Cochran or any part of the defense team, that once, and this goes to the heart of this irony that we're talking about, once the issue of race was on the table, once race became a part of this trial, that the defense never addressed or never tried to address or in any way find an opening in exactly the thing that we're talking about, the fact that O.J. was so much a part of the white community and the lure of white celebrity, as you say, that never even entered into the defense argument as a way to counter some of what was being put forth.
We certainly were obligated, Jeff, to go in the direction that the evidence took us before the trial ever started. We on the defense was confronted with this workers' compensation lawsuit that we found that was filed by Mark Furman, who was one of the central detectives in the case. A lawsuit where he tried to get off of being a police officer because of the stress of dealing with black and brown citizens made him hyper-violent. And that knowledge really crafted the foundation of our defense, coupled with the significant collection issues that we uncovered early on committed by criminalists employed by the LAPD. So we never had to get to that other question. Certainly his celebrity was always the elephant in the room, and we as defense lawyers wanted always to take advantage of that and try to exploit that to our benefit as advocates. But early on, it was clear that race was going to be a central theme in the case, just given the stress lawsuit that Mark Furman had filed years before.
But the idea of race as part of the trial entered long before Mark Furman. I mean, going back to even Shapiro's conversations with Jeffrey Toobin.
But those conversations were based on Shapiro having learned about the lawsuit. But then again, you also have to understand, Jeff, there is rarely an occasion when a trial lawyer in downtown Los Angeles can conduct any kind of a trial without in some ways being mindful of the impact and the influence on race, particularly a criminal trial. Particularly a criminal trial if there is an African-American defendant, whether it's the OJ or no J's of the world. In Los Angeles, a defense lawyer always has to consider whether there is a racial component that the defendant can exploit, because there is such deep-seated distrust in Los Angeles and in many urban areas across this nation between minority communities and their police department.
Given that, and I don't think that there's anybody that could argue that that's not the case, particularly in Los Angeles, given those facts, why do you think, by virtue of hindsight, that the prosecution was so caught, seemingly caught off guard by that issue in this trial?
Oh, because there was so much evidence, Jeff, that they were seduced by the sheer volume and magnitude of the evidence that they were acquiring against Mr. Simpson. And they thought that just the sheer weight of that evidence would trump any other considerations, even of race. And that was a grave misappreciation, if you will, of the central significance that race has in all cases. And they thought there was just so much evidence that it would trump any issues of race whatsoever, I suspect.
And that really was a sense of being not only legally wrong with respect to the trial, but also politically tone deaf with respect to Los Angeles.
Well, you got to understand, though, Jeff, Marcia Clark, who was the lead lawyer, historically, in the 10 years that she had practiced prosecuting cases in downtown Los Angeles, had developed an affinity for African-American women in particular. There were many women who, after they had served on juries, would write her letters or give her phone calls, and they would stay in contact for months, if not years, later. So she thought that she had a particular affinity. She is also a trial lawyer who is, and we by just our very nature, have to have a strong sense of our own self and of our own instincts. Criminal lawyers in particular take great pride in the instinctual nature of our ability to gauge a witness or a situation. And we disdain some of the more traditional tools that civil lawyers use, like jury consultants and focus groups. And so it's with that backdrop that you can appreciate that there was a jury consultant who volunteered his time to the prosecution and advised the prosecution team that female juries were not necessarily pro O.J. Simpson, which was in and of itself counterintuitive. And Marcia ignored that and went with her gut instead.
But doesn't some of the blame, I mean, this was a sense of it that I came away with watching the documentary. To what extent does some of the blame or a lot of the blame have to rest with Gil Garcetti? Because he's a political figure, he's an elected, and the buck stops with him.
The blame for the verdict, I don't place at his feet, other than that he was the district attorney at the time. I applauded the decision that he reached that the case should be tried downtown. Now, legally, initially there was a grand jury that was formed, and there was the prosecution intent to have the case tried, or at least the hearing done by a grand jury, and that has to be downtown in Los Angeles. And Robert Shapiro and Jerry Ullman filed a motion to get that grand jury disbanded, which then kept the case downtown. But because Gil Garcetti was an elected official, he met with members of the African-American community, because this was in the wake of the Rodney King verdicts. And there was great distress among the black and brown communities because the Rodney King trial had been shipped an hour and a half outside of Los Angeles to Simi Valley, which happened to be an area populated by a lot of law enforcement officers. And there was a great sense that that verdict did not speak of justice. And to his credit, Gil was responsive to those voices and came out, as you saw in the documentary, applauding and believing that a case could still be held in downtown Los Angeles and a fair-minded jury could find even O.J. Simpson guilty of murder.
But to your point with respect to the issue of race and cases in downtown Los Angeles, to the extent that he should be applauded for keeping it down there as an elected, absolutely true. But then he shouldn't have been surprised to the extent that race became an issue in this, whereas Marcia Clark seemed surprised at every turn.
Agreed. You know, that is often, Jeff, the elephant in the room, particularly with liberal Caucasians, who will be offended if they were ever accused of being racist, and who often are tone deaf to the racial realities that still exist in a modern, complex American society like ours. I mean, and one of the important things that I like to take from this documentary is, even though we were talking about 1995, these issues are still very, very ripe today. I have a 24-year-old son who did not know about O.J. Simpson then, but really can connect with the issues of race and police misconduct, et cetera, given the headlines that are going on across this great nation of ours.
And talk about your decision to participate in Ezra Edelman's documentary and what you thought that he was trying to put forth.
Well, first of all, I am a great fan of the entire 30 for 30 franchise. Being a sports fanatic, I was very interested in doing something that had the ESPN name attached to it. When I met Ezra Edelman and learned that he is the son of Marion Wright Edelman, the executive director of the Children's Defense Fund, I was very enthused by that because I knew he came from great stock. And then when I thought about the fact that we were talking about, at that time, he was talking about a five-hour documentary, which was, in my mind, an unprecedented commitment to the subject matter. And I realized that O.J. Simpson could not speak, Johnny Cochran was dead, Bob Kardashian was dead, many of the other lawyers, for whatever reasons, on the defense would not speak. I thought it critical, Jeff, that I speak out and that I give balance to the conversation so that someone would be there to give insight to the other side. So I was, you know, it was 20 years, man, so enough time had passed that I could be more candid in some of my discussions and explanations as well.
And are you ever surprised that 20 years later, this is still as central an issue as it is, not only the racial issues that underlie it, but just the fascination with the case and the trial and everything surrounding it?
I am still surprised. I was surprised after 5 years, and then 10, and then 15, and then there was a big swirl of activity after 20. When the People vs. O.J. Simpson series came out on FX, that was another swirl of activity again. And now this great documentary is the topper on all of that. But I think because the more things change, the more they remain the same. And because the documentary focuses as much on issues of race and the evils of celebrity that are still very ripe and relevant today, the trial still captures the fascination of an adoring public.
It is also fascinating. It's impossible to leave out the fact, that, although, as you mentioned before, he's dead, but that Bob Kardashian and his family are symbols of some of the celebrity issues that are aired here in this case.
Yes, and you know, one of the funny little anecdotal scenes was the scene of Tony Ricci, I call him the snake, who was speaking to O.J. in Vegas, and Kim Kardashian was on the screen, and O.J. was her godfather. And O.J. thought that the show she had, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, was never going to be a hit. It'd be off in 2 weeks, and little would he know what an iconic figure she had become as a result of that show.
What does this case tell you about celebrity?
Well, one thing that I knew, but it reinforced to me, is that we Americans love to build our celebrities up, and then we love to watch them be torn down as well. For as many admirers of LeBron James, for example, there are detractors of him as well. And that is one of the curious fascinations that I take from this entire experience.
Carl Douglas, he's prominent in O.J. Simpson Made in America, Ezra Klein's documentary produced by ESPN. Carl, I thank you so much for giving of your time today to us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Jeff, my pleasure having me on, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.